Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. This next story kind of intimidated me a little bit, to be honest. I heard the story, well, part of it anyway. I thought it would be an interesting thing, and then when I really started researching it, I found out that the story was much, much larger than I had actually anticipated. It was all very, really intimidating, and then I realized, you know, I don't really need to present all the information that I can find. So this episode is really only an introduction to this topic, as long as it is. I'm sure entire books have been written on this topic, probably several. This is the story of the Galleonists, who were a subgroup of anarchists who embarked on campaigns of assassination, rioting, and who might be considered one of the earliest examples on American soil of what we would today term organized terrorists. It's almost pointless to discuss the Galleonists, though, without first discussing their quote-unquote founder, a man by the name of Luigi Galliani. The story of Galliani himself serves as a sort of prologue to the later outrages. The heir apparent of Enrico Malatesta, who was referred to as the arch-anarchist by the press, Luigi Galliani was an Italian anarchist who had arrived in the United States in 1901. Now, by the time he arrived here, he was already a habitual provocateur, inciting riots throughout Europe. And as a result, his past years had almost been a constant cycle of deportation and arrest. He would go one place, get arrested for starting a riot, get deported, go to another country, end up getting arrested there, get deported from there, etc., etc. Once he came to the United States, he settled in Paterson, New Jersey, becoming one of the editors of the anarchist newsletter La Question Sociale, or The Social Question. He seemed to be quite narcissist. In speeches, he often made proclamations like, "I am the most intellectual man in America." He came to wide notoriety, however, with the riots in Paterson on June 18, 1902, following a strike of some workers in the silk mills. An excellent newspaper account of the events follows, and I'm going to just quote the entire article rather than trying to sum it up because there's a lot of information in the article. "This city was in the hands of a mob today, and as a result of the riots, a number of persons were shot. And two at least will die. The police were so few in number that they could make little headway against the mob. Mills were wrecked with stones and bullets. By the striking silk dyers, helpers or roughs acting for them, and there were threats to resort to the torch. But so far the mayor hesitates about asking Governor Murphy for troops. There seems to be every indication that the riot was the result of a prearranged plan to involve the would-be peaceful element in the affair from the start. Among the leaders of the trouble was a man named McQueen and another named Galliano, the former an Englishman and the latter an Italian. Others, agents of anarchist circles, have also been quietly fanning the flames. This morning, Chairman McGrath, who has held the strikers in leash since he first obtained control on the second day of the strike, was on hand and presided. He spoke, so did McQueen and Galliano, and the latter working his countrymen into a frenzy. Then McQueen leaped into control of the meeting. He called for a vote on the question of calling for a general strike of all branches of the silk trade. All voted in favor, and a committee was appointed to consider means for bringing the silk workers out. Galliano was one of this committee. It gathered among a babel of tongues and a scene of confusion. 5 minutes later, Galliano emerged from the group shouting something in Italian. Instantly, a mob had formed around him. Into it rushed the Italians, and then the other foreigners, and a moment later, the mob led by Galliano swept down Belmont Avenue. A quarter of a mile down Belmont Avenue stands the Columbia Mill, a silk ribbon factory. The doors had been locked when the mob appeared, but they were forced open, and with the crash of the doors came a volley of stones which riddled the windows and the front of the building. President Grosenauer telephoned for the police. Stones rained into the office and flew about his head. 20 young women on the first floor stood at bay and threatened a fight, and the weavers on the second floor ran down to their aid, but all were forced out of the mill. The mob then swept on down Belmont Avenue. Several members of the Group of Existence, Bresci's old comrades, with Galliano at their head, were in the lead. A half-mile march brought them to the Cedar Cliff Mill, where they stayed until all operatives were out. Just beyond the Cedar Cliff is the Rhine Warner Mill. The doors were burst open here, and the men and girls were found ready to go out. The mill was closed. The next place visited was a cotton braid factory. It seemed to make no difference to the mob whether it was in any way connected with the silk trade or not. The women became hysterical as the howling rioters climbed in windows and burst in the doors. Mr. Reinhardt, the owner, ordered his employees to quit for the day. The Hall Mill, which shelters four silk working firms, was the next point of attack. A single policeman guarded the main entrance. He was ordered to stand aside, and on refusing, he was attacked. He drew his revolver and began to fire. Laura Salvino, an Italian, 24 years old, who lives and works in Hackensack, received the first bullet, which penetrated both lungs. The mob drew back, and the policeman regained his post in the doorway. Several shots were fired at him, but none took effect. He replied, fired directly into the crowd until his weapon was empty. When five more uniformed men and one in plain clothes came on a run through Fulton Street, the mob kept on firing and the policemen charged, firing, when the strikers broke and ran. Spectators say fully 100 shots were fired. Salvino was left behind and was taken to the hospital. 150 hats were picked up in the street afterward, which were lost in the wild scramble to get away. It was about this time that Mayor Hinchcliffe called on the firemen for aid. Men were detailed from each company and armed, and during the afternoon rendered efficient service. The shooting seemed to scatter the rioters, but it was not long before a dense mob had formed again, this time about the Gade Mill on North Straight Street, where there was a crowd of 2,000. Half of them were rioters and the rest onlookers. The mill was bombarded, and before the mob stopped, there was not a whole window in the building. Harry Harris, a reporter on the morning call, was at this point. He was armed with a revolver and had a camera with which he attempted to take pictures, standing on a stoop a short distance down the street. His act of training the camera was seen, and he was warned to desist. A moment later, a rain of stones fell about him, and he was knocked down. As he fell, men rushed on him, and he was kicked and beaten. He drew his revolver and tried to use it, but it was kicked from his hand. A man grabbed it and fired at Harris, the bullet entering his chest. He has a slight chance of recovery. By this time, the mill was emptied of the operatives, and this practically ended the rioting for the day. After all, the mills had closed down. This afternoon, the anarchists, who seemed to be in command, were openly threatening that a policeman's life would pay for each wounded rioter. Galliano, of course, was a misspelling of Galliani. Another article I consulted refers to him as both Galliano and Galliniano. Bresci refers to Gaetano Bresci, who was the Italian anarchist and another resident of Paterson, who assassinated King Umberto I of Italy in 1900. Enrico Malatesta, who was writing to the Paterson anarchists from his home in Europe, was the architect of the plot to assassinate numerous European monarchs. Not just the Italian king, but several other kings and nobility throughout Europe. The mayor, apparently feeling that the police chief was ineffective in his response to the riots, suspended the police chief on June 20th and temporarily assumed command of the police force. The chief, presumably, was reinstated once things settled down. I didn't actually find any newspaper articles confirming that, but I assume it to be the case from the way the suspension was worded in the papers. William McQueen left and was believed to have been in New York, and Galliani fled to Canada, it later turned out. Workers returned to the silk mills, and then that afternoon, a mob of 500 people gathered near the Simons Mill. The police engaged the rioters, and when they arrived, firemen turned hoses on them. The police also raided an anarchist meeting in Sandy Hill, making several arrests. The governor also sent troops, both infantry and cavalry, to Patterson to help maintain order and guard the textile mills. One man who had been arrested following the riots was a German anarchist named Rudolf Grossmann. Now, Grossmann stated that he and McQueen were both invited to Patterson to speak to the striking workers, after which Grossmann left and returned to New York, and McQueen stayed behind for the rest of the riots. So Grossmann was released, and although he also was initially arrested, William McQueen made bail and fled to England. From there, he appealed his conviction repeatedly, and after these appeals failed, he returned to the United States and surrendered to the Passaic County Sheriff to serve his sentence. He also claimed that he was attempting to quell the rioters rather than egg them on, but that was apparently not true. Galliani had been wounded by the police in Patterson, and though he was indicted, he fled to Canada before he could be arrested. In 1904, he was deported from that country. I'm not exactly sure what precipitated him to be deported, but given his record, I'm sure he probably provoked a riot in a factory. And then he eventually wound up in Barre, Vermont, where he began publication of a newsletter called Chronica Subversiva, or the Chronicle of Subversion. Then in winter 1906, New Jersey police officers went to Barre to arrest Galliani for his provocation of the Patterson riots. And on April 24th, 1907, his trial began. His defense meant to put him on the stand to testify in his own defense, and quote, "But when it came to swearing on the Bible, Galliani balked and said he did not believe in the Bible. Judge Scott asked him if he believed in Almighty God, and he said no. He was asked if he believed in an oath, and he replied that he had no religion and did not believe in anything. The court then told counsel that Galliani could not be used as a witness as he was not competent." Now, you can tell it's 1907 because that would never fly today if a court told somebody that they couldn't use a witness because he was an atheist and so therefore he could not possibly be competent to testify. Finally, his defense brought forward two men whose resemblance to Galliani was pretty striking, and they asked all the witnesses whether they could have mistaken either of these two men for Galliani. All witnesses replied to the negative, but the seeds of doubt were sown, and the case ended up being dismissed, the jury being unable to arrive at a unanimous decision. Joseph Sossi, who was another anarchist, also intended to be the publisher of the Chronica Subversiva. Now this is back in Barre before Galliani was arrested, and a war of words ensued between him and Galliani, invoking financial and personal matters. And Sossi was forced out of the anarchist ranks. Now, the interactions with Sossi make me wonder to what extent Galliani was really, like, true anarchist. Because he seemed to believe that he was capable, he could declare that Joseph Sossi was unfit to be an anarchist. Because Joseph Sossi had apparently married in the improper way, because Galliani said there was a certain way that anarchists should get married, that you should live with your wife for such a period of time before marrying her, and Sossi did not do that. So therefore, that made him unfit to be an anarchist. Now, that position, to my mind, seems to be contrary to the very notion of anarchism, because it seems Galliani is setting himself up as a sort of leader, which obviously is what anarchy is opposed to. He proclaimed once that, quote, I do not admit the authority of the government, but I do think it is almost impossible to remove this government at present because society is not in condition to live without government. Whenever man will all be persuaded, then there will be a better form of government, individualism, anarchy. But mankind is too stupid now. Now, this quote also backs up his narcissistic tendencies, thinking, you know, that he can declare that the entire human race is too stupid to govern itself properly. So, in December of 1910, Galliani and Sassi met again. And Galliani once again cast some aspersions on the character of Joseph's wife. So finally, Sassi sued Galliani for slander, and his wife intended to do the same as well. As should be expected because of his history, Galliani could not be found to answer to the lawsuit. In 1918, the offices of the Cronaca Sabursiva, which now that Galliani had been arrested, had been moved to Lynn, Massachusetts. But anyway, the offices were raided. A translation of the Italian language newspaper's contents were not supplied to the post office, as was required by law. Now, this is probably one of those laws that's only rarely actually enforced, but it allowed the Secret Service a toe in the door, as it were. A lot of records were seized of subscribers and things like that. And the newspaper's financiers, who were a barber named Joseph Facile and a music teacher named Edward M. Girardi, were arrested. The Sedition Act was a wartime law which made it illegal to use disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language concerning the government or the military, and also allowed the Postmaster General to decline to distribute any materials which met those criteria. And so, therefore, the Cronaca was effectively dismantled. In early 1919, then, the United States ordered the deportation of Luigi Galliani. I'm not sure where exactly he had been hiding, but apparently he was still in the United States somewhere. But anyway, they ordered his deportation, as well as three other Italian anarchists who were associates of his. Giovanni Frassetti, Giuseppe Solari, and Raphael Schiavino. The stage was set for what was to come. Deportation will not stop the storm from reaching these shores. The storm is within, and very soon will leap and crash and annihilate you in blood and fire. We will dynamite you. Luigi Galliani, shortly before his deportation in 1919. In 1914, several Gallianists led a protest at the home of John D. Rockefeller in Tarrytown, New York. And after police dispersed the protesters, bombings took place in New York City. One of these was a bomb that went off, presumably prematurely, in a tenement building at 1626 Lexington Avenue. Now, I actually went on Google Earth and was looking up that address, and the building is still there. Because I was like comparing it with pictures of the damaged structure from the newspaper and pictures of the building that's at that address now, and it's clearly the same building. And where you can see on the picture of the damaged one, a big piece of the wall was blown off, basically. If you look at this building that's there now, you can see the bricks don't quite line up. They're a slightly different color. So, clearly, after that was bombed, or blew up, rather, because I think it was accidental. I'm pretty sure it was accidental. That's probably just where they were working on the bomb. They simply rebuilt the part of it that had exploded. And on November 14th, the Tombs Police Court was bombed. A bomb was placed under the chair of a magistrate who had sentenced one of the anarchists in the Rockefeller riots. In 1916, a Gallianist from Chicago, by the name of Nestor Dondolio, poisoned nearly 100 people with arsenic at a banquet. Fortunately, a doctor was present, and he managed to make a purgative and administer it to the guests, and none of them died. Later that year, another galleonist named Alfonso Fagotti stabbed a Boston policeman. The next day, a Boston police station was bombed, and as a result, Fagotti was deported. Galleonists were also suspected of having been part of the Preparedness Day bombing in San Francisco, which killed 40 people. Although none of those arrested were galleonists, the bomb itself was felt to be similar in construction to ones used by them later. Now, Preparedness Day was sort of a holiday, memorial, I don't know what exactly you would want to call it. It was held because we were entering into World War I. Now, if there was anyone still alive from World War I, they would tell you us entering into World War I wasn't really anything to celebrate. But, there you go. Another bomb of similar construction to that was confiscated by police in Milwaukee in November of 1917. And that exploded in the police station and killed 10 police officers. At least seven more bombings in which galleonists were implicated took place over the next year. In January 1918, a 19-year-old girl named Gabriella Annalini was arrested in New York with a bag full of dynamite. Now, she said she received the dynamite from Carlo Valdinacci, who was another associate of Galliani. The dynamite was believed to have been intended to be delivered to Mario Buda, who was a bomb maker that was often used by galleonists. The distinctive shrapnel-style bombs used in San Francisco were the style that he usually preferred. And on December 30th, three Buda-style shrapnel bombs were exploded in Philadelphia. These were at the homes of Robert von Moschzisker of the State Supreme Court, Police Superintendent William B. Mills, and Ernest Trigg, President of the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce. Now, that may seem like a bit of a random target to you, and it apparently did to the Philadelphia police as well, because they thought that the bomb had actually been meant for the home of Judge James E. Gorman, which happened to be next door. All of those explosions occurred within a half hour of each other, and near each one was found a pamphlet. To the exploiters, the judges, policemen, the priests and soldiers, you, the handful of parasites who have lived upon your brothers, who have depended on your brothers to slave for you again. We have asked too many times for the right of free speech and free press given by the Constitution. We have asked for bread. The answer by your things in uniform has been anything but justice. Now we have chosen other means. Learn to use weapons instead of words. Man's weapon is now dynamite. Science triumphed over the Torquemada century. Anarchy will triumph over the present Torquemadas of your century. We have demanded the freedom of all political prisoners, a free press, and free speech. You have refused. We war against you. Superintendent Mills said that there was no doubt these outrages are due to a combination of Bolshevism and the IWW because of the activity shown by the police and the courts enforcing the laws against sedition during the war. My life has been threatened half a dozen times recently by unidentified persons who have called me on the telephone or sent me anonymous letters after I had prevented the holding of meetings which I determined would be seditious assemblances. Now, the IWW were the industrial workers of the world. They were a labor organization. They led strikes. Them and the government came into conflict quite often. A massive mail bombing plot came to light in late April. May 1st was a fairly common day on which anarchists would hold demonstrations or launch attacks, and they had threatened some sort of demonstration to protest the imprisonment of Thomas Mooney, who was one of those arrested for the 1916 Preparedness Day bombing in San Francisco. The first bomb of the plot was received by Ola Hansen, the mayor of Seattle, whose administration had opposed a generalized worker strike in that city. The green wrap package contained dynamite, blasting caps, and a sulfuric acid detonator. As it happens, Hansen's bomb was opened by his aide William Langer, and it was opened in such a manner that the vial of acid fell out of the package before it ignited the dynamite, so that was lucky. On April 29, 1919, Senator Thomas Hardwick of Georgia, who had been instrumental in the passage of the amended Immigration Act the year before, which coincidentally was the one which had allowed for the deportation of Luigi Galliani, also received a bomb in the mail, which was opened by his wife. Now, his wife was injured, but she was not killed by the blast. At this time, based upon the distinctive green paper in which the Hansen and Hardwick bombs were wrapped, no less than 16 identical packages addressed to various individuals, mostly captains of industry or various governmental functionaries, were found still sealed at Pennsylvania Station in New York. Several more were recovered by the Bureau of Investigation, which essentially was the FBI. At least 36 were recovered nationwide. Serious injury was avoided in most of the cases, and as far as I can tell, nobody was killed. Targets of the bombs included John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Rame Finch, who was the policeman who had been leader of the 1918 raid on the offices of the Cronaca Subversiva, and A. Mitchell Palmer, who was the Attorney General. Other than that, it was various governors, senators, and district attorneys who had run afoul of anarchists in the past. About a month later, on Monday, June 2nd, bombs went off near the homes of Federal Judge W.H.S. Thompson and W.W. Sebree, who was an immigration inspector, in Pittsburgh. A man named George Oliver and 14 others were arrested. In Newton, Massachusetts, the home of Representative Leland Powers was bombed, as was that of Judge Albert Hayden in Roxbury. A Russian anarchist named Ernest Graldot, who had earlier led a riot in Roxbury, was arrested. A car exploded in Chicago. It's unclear whether it was a car bombing or whether an explosive was being taken to a target area and exploded prematurely, or what exactly happened. Two explosions took place in West Philadelphia as well, at the rectory of a Catholic church at 54th and Vine Streets, as well as at a businessman's house. Several were arrested, but all were released. Another bomb was defused in Paterson, New Jersey. And in New York, two Russians were arrested following the bombing of the home of Judge Charles C. Knott. A threat came in that a power plant in Paterson was to be bombed on June 5th, and guards were placed there, but the threat never materialized. The most famous incident of the June 3rd attacks, however, was the bombing of the townhouse of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer in Washington. Palmer had escaped injury in one of the mail bomb attacks the previous month. The bombing in this case was carried out by Carlo Valdinacci, who also came up earlier. And by some twist of fate, Valdinacci tripped while he was approaching the house, and the bomb detonated prematurely, likely saved Palmer's life, but obviously not Valdinacci. Passing nearby, but uninjured by the blast, were two pedestrians, neighbors of Palmer's who lived across the street. And those pedestrians actually were none other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt. Flyers found near the sites of the bombings were eventually traced to a print shop in New York, and two of its employees, Andrea Salcedo and Roberto Elia, both Galleanist anarchists. They were taken into custody, and on May 4th, Salcedo fell out of a window in a federal building. Elia claimed at the time that Salcedo had committed suicide rather than betray fellow anarchists. Later, he claimed that federal investigators threw Salcedo from the window. The truth of the matter is still unclear. Elia himself was deported. Around noon on September 16, 1920, a horse and wagon paused in front of the offices of the J.P. Morgan building on Wall Street in New York. The wagon was carrying 100 pounds of dynamite and 500 pounds worth of iron shrapnel and industrial parts. It exploded, killing 38 people and destroying much of the interior of the building. The bombing was believed to have been the work of Mario Buda, the bomb maker mentioned earlier. This was confirmed in 1955, when the aging Buda was interviewed in Italy. Buda had also been a suspect in the 1916 Preparedness Day bomb in San Francisco, as well as the bomb that exploded at the Milwaukee police station in 1917. Two other friends of Buda's had been arrested the month before in Massachusetts, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, who were embroiled in a controversial murder case. It is thought that the Wall Street bombing was retaliation for those arrests. Actually, if you go to that area of Wall Street, even today, there's still damage on some of the buildings from the bombings. Nearly as soon as the June 3rd, 1919 attack wave occurred, Congress began to mobilize to more effectively deal with the anarchist threat. Attorney General Palmer got approval to crack down on subversives and led a massive raid on November 7th of that year. Agents of the Bureau of Investigation and local police raided anarchist and suspected communist cells in 12 cities. A second set of raids took place in January and February of 1920. Now, these were organized by Palmer's protege, another person who would become famous, J. Edgar Hoover. Like the previous raids, accusations of police brutality, wrongful arrest, and breach of legal norms ran rampant. In the course of the so-called Palmer raids, 3,500 people were imprisoned and 556 were deported. In June 1920, a Massachusetts judge named George Anderson ruled that 17 of those arrested were to be freed. In addition, he delivered an invective against the raids, stating that, quote, "A mob is a mob, regardless of whether made up of government officials acting under instructions from the Department of Justice or of criminals and loafers and the vicious classes." And that's the end of this episode. A list of the sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, post it on my Facebook page at Andrew D. Gable, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, @gmail.com. And so until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.